thank you for having me here today. So what are contracts? Contracts are executable specifications of components. Basically, the programmer specifies something, some properties that he wants to hold for the values, the functions, the mutable data that the component exports. And then, automatically, the runtime system of the language generates monitors that make sure that at runtime, dynamically, these properties hold. At the same time, if something goes wrong, the runtime system is going to pinpoint to the component that broke the contract. We call that blame assignment. So contracts, based on these two points, are very close to any other form of dynamic specifications. They have a difference, though, and this is that you can use a full programming language to specify these contracts. And this is what makes them extremely popular nowadays. They are part of many languages, either as native support or as third-party libraries. And it's also their weak point. Because they become extremely expressive and extremely powerful really fast with a small effort from the programmer, they are also hard to understand. And this is what we do comes in. We're trying to understand what it means for contracts to be correct, for the contract monitoring system to do its job. It's a language property. It doesn't put any weight, it doesn't request any more effort from the programmer. It's just something that the language designer has to think about. It's some principles about adding and extending contract systems. And we call those complete monitors. And the key insight, the key idea that allowed us to get these complete monitors is provenance. I would like now to make a small parenthesis about what we mean by provenance in our setting. So I've been listening to the talks here and I've been reading papers on provenance, and I understand that provenance is associated to data, raw data, like documents, structured data. In programming languages, that's not the case, though. Provenance is related to any possible value, functions, objects, strings, closures, everything. And the reason for that is that for the last 30 years, programming languages people started thinking about functions and behavior also as data, but a different kind of data, an infinite kind of data. So basically, a function is nothing else but a finite representation of an infinite way to get a lot of data. And because of that, in our setting, also these infinite objects will have provenance. So enough with the vague and abstract words. Let's go to what I think is our common denominator, and this is codes, programs, and examples. So the first example is a real story. A colleague of mine decided that he was bored of doing manual work all the time to submit his code to GitHub. So he decided to write a script, a small program connected to a plugin in his favorite editor, and automate the communication with GitHub. In order to do that, he needed something to authenticate himself, and he needed to use an encode function. So he picked up his favorite encoding library, and he started to use it. His library is written in a typed language. So encode specifies in the type that it expects a string, and it's going to give us back a string. But our guy wants more from encode. He wants to know that encode doesn't consume any kind of string, but strings that do not have end of lines inside them. It's a subset of all the strings. It's something that he doesn't know how to define in the type system of the language. Maybe it doesn't permit it, but you can definitely define it as a predicate over strings. And similar for the results. He wants the results to be codes that are encoded. Encoded means that they follow exactly what the JSON parser on the GitHub side expects, a specific format. And he also read the JSON parser and wrote encoded as another function, as a predicate over strings here. So this specification is now a comment. It's never going to be run. Nobody's going to check it. And the author of this module hopes that everybody who is going to use the module is going to respect the specification. And he also hopes that he respects the specification himself. So now his library, utils, lives inside this complicated system. And it communicates with the JSON parser eventually. Unfortunately, the moment my friend tried to use his plugin, he saw a bug. And it was a very complicated bug. It took him about a whole afternoon to understand what was going on with this bug. And he used the help of another very experienced programmer we have in the group. It was something with the JSON parser, but he couldn't figure out what was going on. After 7 or 8 hours, he realized that the problem is that his function and code doesn't actually do what he was expecting it to do. Even though he worked hard to make sure that encode returns encoded strings, the strings that encode return were not encoded. So he violated himself, his own specification. And because he didn't have a way to observe this thing, the error propagated and finally showed up somewhere else. And he had to reconstruct the whole path of the value to figure out what was going on. There is a way around that, and it's called contracts. And it's a very easy way to add expressive specifications to languages. Actually, the only thing we have to do here, in our example, is to remove the comment. Contracts, as I said, have the advantage that you can form them using the language itself. So we can use the no end of line string. We can use the no end of line predicate. We can use the encoded predicate, put them together with a contract combinator, this arrow. We borrow a lot of notation from type systems, so they are also familiar to the user. And now we have a contract. And what does this mean? Let's dive inside the interaction between utils and plugin to see how this contract is going to work. So I'm using this interaction diagram to describe the interaction between the two components. The two big blocks correspond to the components. And then we have one channel for the argument and one channel for the result. So the moment we add contracts, what happens is that we install filters on top of these channels. So the first string is it doesn't contain any end of lines. So it passes from the plugin to the utils component, but the second one doesn't. The moment utils try to return the result, we detect it. And furthermore, not only we isolate the mistake, the bug, at the point where it was born, but we can also pinpoint to the component that broke the contract. This is what we call blame. And blame, in this setting of first-order functions, functions that consume flat values and give us back flat values, is pretty straightforward. For all failures or the preconditions, like no AOL, we are going to blame the client, in this case, plugin. For all failures or the post conditions, we are going to blame the server, in this case, utils. Someone might say that, OK.
So just
yes.
Operationally, when the violation happens, does everything just stop?
So Usually it's an error that it's uncodable, and it propagates to the top level and then the computation stops. But practically this is not what should happen, because sometimes you want to recover from this kind of errors. Exactly, yeah. So from what we've seen, contracts give you a lot of expressive power, but they also look a lot like types. So some people might start thinking that contracts are not nothing new. They are just fancy types. They are just like dependent types. They push the borders of decidability, and they're trying to give us more and more things that we can reason about when we think about programs. However, this is not true. Let's look at this easy example. We have a subtraction function, and we have a contract around it. And now what the contract says is that the argument and the result, if we pass them to the McCarthy 91 function, they should be equal to 91. So McCarthy 91 function is a notorious function for verification people. For some inputs, it gives you 91. For some other inputs, it gives you the input minus 10. But it's a very recursive function. And because of this characteristic of the function, it's a function that is extremely difficult to decide if it terminates or not for a given input. Actually, verification people have been trying for the last 20 years to figure out if the McCarthy function terminates for all inputs, and they have failed. And it looks like it's beyond verification's abilities right now. So this statement can never show up in even in the most advanced type system. Because if we can't verify that this thing is going to terminate, we can't verify if this equation holds. So type systems are not powerful enough to capture what we can capture with contracts extremely easily. But this is not the whole truth. Contracts are more expressive than types in some cases. There are other cases where contracts are less expressive than types. They give you different guarantees. For instance, again, we have this abstraction function, and now we want it to work only with numbers that are greater than zero. And we hope that the result is going to be greater than zero. I hope you all agree that obviously this function doesn't meet the contract. I mean, for one input, specifically number one, we are going to get back something that's not greater than zero. We're going to get back zero. So from a type perspective, we should reject this thing. We should say that there is a type violation. However, this doesn't happen. For instance, if we apply two and we run the thing, we will see that nothing happens. No contract is violated. So contracts are dynamic beasts. They don't consider all possible executions like a type system does. They focus only on the specific trace, the specific execution, where the specific program, like here, and they tell you if this specific execution satisfies the contract or not. So you cannot get the global guarantees you get from types, even though you can express easily very rich properties. So in this world that I've been talking about, the world of first-order functions, of primitive values, of functions that consume flat values and give you back flat values, contracts are pervasive. They are there for the last 30 years. Eiffel and Bernhard Meyer popularized them. They preached about them based on the design by contract paradigm, and they've made it everywhere. They are part of C now in the form of systematic assertion writing, part of C++, part of SpecSARP, everywhere. And the reason they're everywhere is because we understand them really well as a pair of two assertions. One, before we call a function on the argument of the application, and one when the application returns on the result of the function. And we know very well how to pinpoint the violator of a contract. We blame the context or the user of the function from violations of the preconditions, and the function itself and the component that provides it for violations of the postcondition. However, our world is not first order. We live in a higher order world. We live in a world where every day we use things like objects, closures, and we use those things even though we don't really realize that they are higher order. For instance, this is the Bible of object-oriented programming, and it's full of patterns where people pass around objects. An object is really a higher order function, but the difference is that it has multiple entry points. And the function is also an object, but the difference with a normal object is that it has one single entry point. So the modern world of software is a higher order world. And if we want contracts in the first order world, we also need them in the higher order world. And we don't need them just to attach them to first order functions. We want to be able to have contracts that say that this function consumes an object with these constraints, or that this function consumes another function with these constraints. And we want to be able to monitor these higher order contracts. Things like that, for instance. This is a piece of a mathematics library. It's a derivative operator. And again, the author used the type system to say that it consumes a function f from reals to reals, and a positive number around which it's going to compute the derivative. But he wants something more. He wants to restrict the kind of function that his operator uses. He wants to say that these functions operate inside the ring minus 1 to 1. And he wants to know something more about the result. And there are more things that a writer of a derivative operator would want. For instance, he would like to be able to express and monitor this property, the ultimate property of correctness about the derivative operator, that the slope of the function that we provide to the derivative operator is very close to the result of the first derivative. And we can do it with contracts. We have a whole language. Nothing stops us from doing this thing. We can define slope. We can bring f and f prime in the same scope and compare their difference with delta. And not only that, we can do a trick. We don't want this thing to run, this check to run every time we call f prime on every result of f prime. We may want to test it every time we call the derivative function instead. And in this case, we need to generate things to provide to f and f prime. And we have a way to do it. We can call a random function. And we can do it even more times, 10 times, to get better assurance that this randomized testing of the property holds. And it's all part of the contract. This kind of contracts are very important because they allow you to state properties of the result that depend on the argument. We call them dependent contracts. And they look really easy to write. But as we will see, they are extremely subtle. So let's go back to the higher order contract and see why going from first order contracts to higher order contracts, even though it looks like a small step in terms of programming effort, is a really big step in terms of how we check these things. So the world now looks like that. We have a physics library that wants to communicate with the math library. The physics guy wants to provide a speed function and get back an acceleration function using the derivative operator. So we go inside their interaction, and everything looks as before. We have the channels, and on top of the channels, we have these very nice filters. And everything works as before for delta, for instance. It's a flat value. So we can check it on the fly, and we can decide if it's positive or not. But now here is the problem. We have a function and we want to make sure that the function meets the contract. We can't do that on the fly. It's undecidable when the postcondition and the precondition are arbitrary predicates. So we are stuck. We can't do what we were doing in the first order world. We have to find a trick, a solution. So 10 years ago, Findler and Feleisen suggested such a solution. They said, okay, we don't need to check things right now. We can delay checking. We can wrap speed with something that every time we use this something, it's going to check that the precondition holds on the argument and the postcondition holds in the result. So basically, the wrapper of speed becomes a function. A function that first checks if the argument is inside this ring, then calls speed to get the result, check the results, and if any of these checks fail, it gives us back an error. And we do exactly the same thing with f prime. So now, in our world, instead of having these naked values going around, what we really have is these wrapped values. And these wrapped values carry inside them contract checks. They carry inside them the monitors. So when we go down there to chemistry, yes, please. The delayed checking.
So it could be that you will pass all your checks even though the function, some other value, returns something out of the interval, right?
I'm
essentially probing at certain points to make sure that the precondition of the contract holds.
Okay, so here, for instance.
Right, so I'm checking it for whatever value of x I'm actually evaluating the function for.
Yes.
But it could be that if I had tried some different value of x that I didn't happen to try in this run, then I would have found that the contract actually doesn't hold.
Exactly.
Is there a notion of, correctness or something of all this that says that this is okay? That
yes.
It would be like observationally equivalent to some other speed prime, which does satisfy the contract.
So you're talking about a model of this operation that we're doing
in
here.
In some sense, it's incorrect to accept the speed function that happens to do the right thing on all the points I care about, but in reality, it's not correct.
So it's the distinction between types and contracts, again. So types give you global guarantees. They tell you that the moment you attach a type on a value and it passes the type checker, you know that in every context, the value is going to behave in a specific way. With contracts, you don't have this guarantee.
Okay.
They are much weaker.
So we relax our expectations.
Exactly.
So
what they tell you is that we are going to wrap the value for you, and whenever you use it, we're going to make sure that the things stated in the contract hold. If they don't, we're going to throw an error.
Okay.
So you may have a speed that doesn't satisfy this property.
Okay.
But you use it only in ways.
Yes.
So yes, exactly. It's a very dynamic, it's part of the philosophy of contracts. It's a very dynamic way of thinking these things. So the world now looks like that. We have wrappers going around instead of the naked values. And then we arrive in the chemistry component. And the chemistry component misuses our acceleration function. And we have an error. But now we have the problem. Who are we going to blame for this error? If we say that the chemistry component did the mistake, then we sent the programmer in a wild goose hunt. He will tear apart the code of the chemistry component and find nothing there, because there is nothing related to the chemistry component. If we send him go back all this chain, it's hopeless. Imagine a system with thousands of components, and now we have objects going around, so the flow, the control, the data, they become all so complicated and very dynamic. We need somehow to tell to the programmer where to look for the bug. And this is what blame is for. And this is why Findler and Feleisen, when they started thinking about contracts, they decided that inside these wrappers, it would be really good to keep some information about who the contract was agreed between. For instance, here we have speed passing from the physics library to the math library. And speed passes under a contract between the math component and the physics component. So math and physics are the two responsible parties for the contract. And they are responsible for specific parts of the contract. For instance, math is responsible for the values that speed is going to see, because this wrapped version of speed is going to live inside math. And physics is responsible for the results of speed, because it's the one that provides physics, that provides speed. And something similar is going to happen here with F prime. But note that the parties are reversed now. Why is that? Because F prime, the first derivative, is going to be used inside the physics library. So it's natural to keep responsible for the precondition, the physics library, while for the postcondition, we have the math library, because F prime is a product of the math library. So we have this very dynamic way of keeping track of who is responsible for what, baking this information inside the wrappers we make, flipping this information every time we go from argument to result, like we did here, and we hope it works correctly. If we follow this way of monitoring contracts, by the time we reach chemistry and something goes wrong, we get the blame information that points us back to physics. Why does it point us back to physics? Why is this correct? And the answer is that physics and math got into an agreement. And physics promised that anybody who is going to use this acceleration function, he's going to apply the acceleration function only to numbers between minus 1 and 1. And then he started, the physics component started passing around acceleration function to other people without telling them about the agreement, about the contract. So if one of these unaware components broke the contract because they were never informed about the contract, then it's not their fault. And where we should look for a fix, for a bug, is here in physics. And the fix is that physics should be more careful and put another contract around the things that it exports to its peers, to the other components. So high-order contracts and the way we describe them gives us a mechanistic sense of how blame works, how we monitor things. But sometimes this is not enough, because it doesn't give us enough insight about the workings of higher-order contracts. There are cases like this one where higher-order contracts are counterintuitive. For instance, we have the ID function. ID function is the function that returns the argument that we pass it. It doesn't do anything. So we want to restrict it to an ID function only, that consumes only functions from reals to reals. And furthermore, with the contract, we want to make sure that these functions are actually in the ring from minus 1 to 1. So the writer of this piece of code thought that since he's not going to use F, but he's just going to give it back, he's covered by this contract that never fails. What this contract says is that I give you back a function, but I don't ask you to do anything with this function specific, and I don't promise you anything in return. So I hope you all agree that at the first glance, this contract will never fail. And if for some reason it fails, it will never blame the writer of the identity function. He didn't promise anything. He didn't ask anything in return. However, this is not true with contracts. For instance, let's look at this possible client of our component. So this guy passes add one to the ID function and gets back a new function, plus one, and then applies plus one to two. So what is going to happen here? Let's run the thing. So we have add one flowing inside the utils thing through the ID function. Add one is wrapped, and we get back plus one. And plus one is also wrapped. Let's look inside plus one. Let's see exactly what it is. Plus one has actually two wrappers around it. It has the wrapped version of add one, and it has the second wrapper because of the post condition. So add one really sits here in the bottom, and there are two contracts on the way from the argument to add one. So the moment we apply two, it's going to satisfy the first one because it never fails, but it's going to violate the second one. And in this case, the contract system is going to blame the utils library, the provider of ID. This is counterintuitive because we were expecting that this is not going to happen. The ID function didn't ask anything here. How can he get blamed? And here is the first hint that provenance plays an important role into understanding contracts. This guy may not promise anything to anybody about the result, but he promised something about the argument. He promised that he's going to use the argument only in this small ring from minus one to one. And then he pretended like he forgot about it. But the value that he has in his hands, the value that was passed to the ID function, comes from the context and carries with it all the obligations that this function met along the way. And it keeps carrying them, even when this guy returns the function. That's why we have these double wrappers around the result of the identity function. And that's why we blame this component for forgetting to protect something that he got from someone else, for pretending like he had no obligations before. So because of these difficulties with the meaning of contracts, with understanding how contracts work, language designers have restricted themselves only to first-order contracts. There is only one language out there, and this is Racket, the language of the group I work for, that tried to push contracts for all higher-order features. And even in this case, every day we figure more and more bugs. And here is where provenance is going to help us. It's going to help us build a criterion, a formal criterion, a formal way to reason about contracts and decide if they are right or wrong. So let's go back to the first order, to the higher order example of the derivative function we had. And before provenance, the world looked like that, black and white. Now with provenance, I will bring some color. So what I do is that I pick a color for its component. Red for the physics, blue for the math. And every value that the component produces keeps its provenance information. It keeps the color of the component where it comes from. In addition, we use colors to paint the contracts. and the colors correspond to the component who is responsible for meeting this contract, the component who is responsible for providing the value to this filter. So for instance, here it's red because physics is also red, and this is blue because the value comes from math, and math is also blue. And this is something we also do for the wrappers. The precondition is blue because the context is blue, and the postcondition is red because the value itself is red, the provider of the value. And now a pattern, a coloring coordination pattern, starts to emerge. Whenever we have a foreign value, like this one inside the component, this value is always protected, guarded by the contract. And not only it's guarded by the contract, but the precondition check matches the color of the context, and the postcondition check matches the color of the value itself. This color coordination is just not a formalistic way to talk about contracts. It's also something that is very important for practical reasons, because it gives us two pieces of information. The first one is that the contract system does check foreign values whenever they pass from one component to the other. Whenever we have a value with a different color, which means that its provenance is different than the component it currently resides, this value is going to be wrapped. Also, it tells us things about blame, and blame is important for debugging. It tells us that the precondition on these wrappers, it's always going to match the context. So if it's going to fail, it's always going to blame the context, the guy who provided the value. And the postcondition is going always to blame the value itself, the creator of the value that broke the contract. So with this color coordination, we get a criterion about the correctness of contracts. And this color coordination holds no matter what we will do with the system that Finder and Feleisen suggested. For instance, if we use f prime again with the derivative operator, trying to get the second derivative, we are going to get a stack of wrappers around f prime. And this stack of wrappers will have the right colors. It will respect this coordination. We call that complete monitors. And we claim that this coloring pattern is the essence of the correctness of contract checking, because it gives us, as I said, two important properties: correct blame and complete mediation. So now we have a formal way, a formal criterion that each programming language designer, each contract system designer can take, apply it to his system, and if the system meets this criterion, he can come back and say to the programmers that they can trust the contract system. And can trust it in two ways. They can trust it to give them accurate information when things go wrong, and he can trust the contract system also that it protects all foreign values. When they leave one component, they go to the other. That the contract system is always there. It doesn't allow for backdoors, for leaks between components that can circumvent contract checking. Let's see what our approach is going to tell about the most expressive contracts that we've seen today, dependent contracts, and the dependent example for the derivative function. So what the problem is here is that we have two functions sitting inside the contract, two unknown functions, two free variables that may have their own specifications. How are we going to collect those specifications? And if we do collect them, are we going to enforce them? And if we enforce them, who are we going to hold responsible for violating the specifications? So if we go back to the diagram, the interaction diagram, the world looks like that. We have the postcondition box, this is the big difference, attached to the result. It's another kind of check. And then we have values flowing inside the postcondition box, and we have to decide exactly what those values are. In the history of contracts, there have been two different approaches in what those values are. The first one is called the lax approach. And this lax approach said that, you know, the postcondition is part of the specification. And usually specifications are saying code, so we should trust them. They're not going to do anything to break any kind of specification that speed or F prime have on them. So why do we need to check those specifications? So their answer was, take F prime and speed and put them as they are inside the postcondition. Let's see the practical implications of this thing. Let's look at them through the example that we have. We are calling a random number here. And the random number is not sure that it's going to give us something between minus 1 and 1. It may give us minus 2, for instance. And then this may cause F to blow. Because F, as you can see here, it's only supposed to work inside the ring from minus 1 to 1. And what happens if, F prime. What happens if F prime blows? Then the writer has to go, the author has to go and check the code of F prime. But there is nothing wrong with the code of F prime. There is something wrong with the contract here. But we missed it. And we will lose a lot of time trying to figure out the mistake. Same goes with F. And here things are even worse because F comes from the context. So this guy, the author of the math module, is going to get into a debate with his client about a possible bug. The client is going to say, it's not my fault, I do everything correctly, and then how are they going to figure out what's going on? The contract system doesn't give them any information. And maybe slope breaks the thing. Maybe F and F prime work with minus 2 accidentally, and maybe we will get an error in slope, and now we are going to look inside slope. That might be correct. But there is an even scarier possibility. And this possibility is that nothing will break. And we will have a contract success. But this success is meaningless because the test, the contract that we run, is on a value that is outside of the intended domain of use. So the contract system tells us that everything is OK, but it does it without having the right to do that, without having done its job. So it's obvious from that that lax does not protect enough. And if we use provenance and or complete monitoring, this becomes apparent. The moment we turn colors on, you can see that we have a foreign value here, speed, that is inside the host component with a different color, with different provenance, and this value is unprotected. So we can say for sure that this semantics does not respect or provenance principles, that they don't protect enough. And this is only possible because we've started thinking about provenance and colors. So some other people said, OK, we have these specifications are part of the contract for F and F prime. So why not use those specifications to protect F and F prime inside the post condition? And they did that. They said, OK, speed and F prime are wrapped anyway, why not bring them as they are inside the post condition? And this looks much better now because we have more checks. So we protect more things, we catch more errors. But let's look at the labels. What happens here? We have math responsible for the precondition here and physics responsible for the post condition. and the reverse situation for f prime. So if we look at our code, this means that for f prime, a value that is produced from the math library, we held responsible math for the result. And this is correct. But for uses of f prime inside the math library, we also held responsible physics. What does physics have to do with the uses of f prime inside the contract? Nothing. And it has no way to protect itself from this kind of violations. But it's going to get blamed if f prime is applied to minus 2, like in this case. So there's something wrong with blame. And we can see it again immediately, the moment we bring provenance into the way we think. So let's look at f prime. It's a blue value. The post condition is also blue. So this agrees with our color coordination. But the precondition is red in a context that it's blue. This breaks the coordination that we set up before, the one that guarantees that we get the correct blame. So just from looking at this colorful picture and thinking about provenance, we can find a way to say that picky, this kind of semantics for contracts, is wrong. It doesn't blame correctly all the time. It can blame the wrong party. And not only that, but we can fix it. What can we do? We can go and change the party that is responsible for the precondition. Let's make it blue. Let's make it a responsibility of the math library, which the contract is part of the math library. So now everything works really fine. And we can even generalize that. We can say, OK, in a world where components form a market of their own and people start using third-party components, why not see the contract as a component on its own? And this component, of course, like any other component, has its own obligations. And we can figure them out by looking at the colors, by looking at provenance. For instance, in this case, where our guy found somewhere on the web a contract for the derivative function, and he decided to put together with his derivative operator. And this is not something that we just claim that is correct. It's something that we can actually prove. And we can syntactically express this color coordination. We can enforce it on source programs and then show that our semantics preserve provenance. And thus, they preserve the coloring pattern. And they are correct. So we went back to Racket, and we changed it, because it wasn't indie. It was lax, and it was wrong for 10 years. And now this part of Racket is fixed. There are many more parts that we need to explore and fix, but at least we've done that much. So I'd like, yes. Yes, it's in before us.
Formulating what you view as more reasonable formal criteria for correctness, and it fails that.
So the implementers of LAX at the beginning thought that contracts can never be wrong themselves. They cannot have any contradictions in themselves. They are specification code, and they assume that they are so small that the author is going to take some time and think about them correctly and not introduce any bugs. Of course, as the code base started increasing, this wasn't true anymore. And especially as contracts are code themselves and they can call other functions and they can call other objects. So they didn't have a formal criterion. They had just a philosophy. And we saw that this philosophy is wrong, according to our criterion. So I want to sum up the idea of complete monitoring. So we have two components, one on the left, one on the right. And these components internally may consist of many more other components that may communicate in many different ways. And now we want these two big components to communicate with each other. But we don't want this communication to happen in an unregulated way. We want it to go through a contract monitor, and we want to make sure that this contract monitor is always going to check the values, always going to attach the right checks around the values that go from one component to the other. Which means that we want to exclude any channels that circumvent this monitor. And the moment we bring provenance into our way of thinking about contracts, stating that, proving it, reasoning about contracts becomes easy. These channels, if they exist, they are going to be detectable, and we can remove them. Also, as you see here, these boxes have nothing really to do with functions or functional contracts. They are very abstract notions. And there is nothing stopping us from applying this idea of complete monitoring to other settings. And we've done that. We've done that for contracts for mutable data, objects, inheritance, even classes that you can pass around as other values, functions that consume these classes and compose other classes, polymorphism. And we have also done it to show that it's safe to embed untyped code inside typed code using contracts as the medium of communication between those things. Complete monitoring is the only thing you need to require from the contract system. It's sufficient to prove the soundness of mixed programs. So provenance is the key to understand contracts. And this is the message of this talk. But since the work on contracts has benefited so much from provenance, I would like to return the favor, sort of, and ask you, what can contracts do for provenance? And I think there are a couple of things they can do that are within reach. So for instance, we know that there is all this support for keeping track of provenance in the operating system level, on the hardware level, on the applications level, with workflow systems, with libraries. There is something missing all over the literature on this top-down approach to keeping track of provenance. And this is linguistic support. Language can be the link that can bring information from the application down to the operating system and the hardware. And it can do that in a very reliable way, because language people have the experience to reason about the systems that they create formally, and they can give strong or weaker guarantees about them. And maybe contracts, it's the right place. Maybe it's a familiar place for the programmer to add the opportunity for tracking and recording provenance. And maybe it's also the right place to ask questions about provenance, not using a new language, but using familiar combinators. This way, inside the language, someone can ask questions about provenance with the same effort as using his favorite library about provenance. And furthermore, we can use contracts and the results, the theoretical results that tell us that we can trust monitors to make sure that policies, like security policies based on provenance, hold, and they are monitored during an execution. And finally, yesterday I heard Marco Seltzer saying, for instance, that when we keep track of provenance, we don't know where to stop, because we also want to keep provenance for the provenance. And we have the problem, who is responsible for this provenance? And this creates an infinite thing. Maybe we shouldn't leave that to the user. Maybe we should use contracts to keep track of this thing. And we know already that they can somehow track some sort of provenance information. And maybe they can do that reliably for other forms of provenance information. And finally, if provenance is going to be the next big thing, it can be the next big thing based on a clean slate. It has to be done gradually, taking into account legacy code, old systems, things that people use. And contracts have been proven really good at increasing gradually the awareness of applications and programs to some constraints. For instance, we use them to turn untyped code into typed code gradually. Maybe we can use them to turn code that knows nothing about provenance into code that gradually learns more stuff about provenance. Thank you so much for inviting me here. I would also like to thank my co-authors and the Racket community, because without the 20 years of Racket programming and the collective experience of this community, this work would not be possible. Thanks, Angie. Yes. So in complete monitors, we assume that between different colors, there is always a contract.
Okay, so the output
is colored by the contract. So the output is a wrapper. So in this case, the output is a green wrapper that has inside it the red value. So it will be always something protected by the contract system. Yes.
So first, I want to know. I mean, so we've been having these discussions about the term provenance and that different communities use provenance in different ways, and I wanted to know how you came up with this concept and where you saw the relationship and how this idea actually came about. Just more like provenance of your provenance.
Yes. So actually, the beginning was something that had to do with type abstraction. And when people started to study type abstraction, they used this idea of colors, basically pieces of code that have abstract types. These are types that you can only access through some operators, and you cannot look inside their values. So they had different color than their context. And they used these colors to make sure that the soundness of the system holds. But then I started looking back from there, and I saw that there was work on information flow, for instance,
right,
that is related to these things. And from that, I reached to a paper called The Provenance in the Future, or Future of Provenance, that showed up in Uppsala. It's a thesis paper, yes, from 2 years ago. And from there, I started. I realized that there are people who put a lot of thought on these ideas, and I started reading more about
okay,
that.
Okay.
Okay, good. Thank you.
Yeah. Thank you.
Okay, so if there are no more questions, let's thank our speaker. Thank you.